Hello, this is Jazza from the Right Dishonourable podcast, though you probably already know this because you've either clicked on us or you've downloaded us in iTunes. Regardless, hello, did you hear Jimmy's little spiel at the beginning of last week's episode? Wasn't he good? Didn't he sound professional? Well, it's my turn this time around, and I'm here to urge you to go and vote for us at the British Podcast Awards. It feels like every British podcast is asking people to do this, but we're particularly special because, I mean, we are your favourite, let's be fair. All you need to do is go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and vote for us, please. This week we're also doing something a little bit special. At the end, after all of the outros and stuff, we're doing a bit of user engagement. So if you make sure you stick around for that, that would be good. Okay, well, on with episode 73, shall we? I think
so. We do this every single time.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to episode 73 of the Right Dishonourable podcast. My name is Jimmy Nichols, and as per usual, I'm joined by Jazza John. Jazza, how are you?
Great, good, fantastic.
Fantastic. Mm. We are also this week joined by James O'Malley, who's a freelance journalist who currently works at Gizmodo. James, maybe you'd like to just start by telling the listeners a bit about yourself.
Yeah, as you say, I'm a freelance journalist. I'm the interim editor at the moment of Gizmodo UK. That's the UK edition of the big tech blog Gizmodo. But I must say, I am here in a personal capacity, so all of my opinions, all of my controversial opinions that I'll no doubt express over the next few minutes are entirely my own terrible opinions rather than those of anyone I work for. But also, I've written for, you know, various other places, The New Statesman, Alpha.com. I work for Independence Voices, just various places that I can't even remember to name, but that sort of thing. That's what I do with my time.
Whereabouts would you sit yourself on the political spectrum, would you say?
Oh, that's a very good question. I usually say sort of somewhere on the left, I think. You know, previously I would describe myself as more left-wing. Clearly, given the current political context, I don't think I am as left-wing as I once thought I was.
Is that because of Jeremy Corbyn and the fact that he exists?
Perhaps. I mean, you know they say you get more right-wing as you get older. I can't work out if that's happening to me or if I'm standing still and the rest of the sort of political left has gone a bit insane and gone a bit over to the other side. So I think now I tend to sort of, if pushed, I would describe myself as a sort of social democrat, I think. But I can't pin myself down. I'm one of those people who, you know, voted Lib Dem until the coalition, then voted Labour at the last election. Now I'd probably vote Lib Dem again. That's, you know, I'm flaky like that. That's probably where I am.
Well, I'm sure we'll try and establish in more detail where exactly you sit on certain issues.
And we'll give you a score at the very end. No, we won't. That's not going to happen.
We'll do that when we turn the microphones off.
Yeah.
But we're, as per usual, going to talk about three topics covering social issues, current events and politics. Jazza, what's the first topic we're going to be looking at?
IndyRef 2, Return of the Sturgeon, I guess. It would be the movie Violet. No, you don't like it? Well, very well.
Well, Salmon led the first one, so...
Return of the Fish, because they're all fish.
Fish version 2.
Yeah.
But this is obviously the news that Nicola Sturgeon is going to ask the UK government for permission to hold another referendum. She suggested before the Brexit process is actually finished, but we currently don't know what the UK government position is on that. So it's all a little bit up in the air.
It's pretty... No, we do. It's pretty, like, nah, isn't it?
There was a definite sense of nah, but it's all a bit... It's a bit ambiguous at the moment, but that will be the first topic. And then following on from that, we are going to cover the government's U-turn on national insurance contributions. As part of the budget, Philip Hammond, who is the Chancellor of the UK at the moment, proposed these increases in tax for self-employed people, which provoked a huge backlash from not least from freelance journalists who don't appreciate that sort of thing. I'm sure James can inform us a little bit more about that perspective.
Are we all self-employed, by the way.
I'm actually employed.
Oh, yeah, no, you are employed. So you're fine. Well, screw you.
Yeah, but anyway, those changes are not coming into effect now. Yeah. I'm not 100% au fait with the exact details of what went on, so we will discuss that in further detail. And then finally, we are going to look at a European Court of Justice ruling on religious clothing, which has been portrayed as a ban on Muslim headscarves of various sort.
But I mean, because that's the only time that it's ever going to happen, really.
Yeah,
like they say a ruling on religious clothing, but they mean specifically the hijab and the veil, right? That's the one that people have an issue with.
More on that later.
Okay. Fun times.
But James, to start us off, what are your thoughts on the whole Scottish situation at present?
So my sort of gut reaction on seeing Nicola Sturgeon make the announcement was, well, that's it. We've lost Scotland now, I think. I mean, given how close it was last time, it seems that, you know, give them another 2 years to have a long campaign and they can nudge public opinion a bit further. So I do think that, you know, we probably will see the end of the United Kingdom if they can get a referendum. I mean, I think I think there was a poll published yesterday which said like it's like 50-50 down the middle, but there was some quite big error bars on it, I think, and so that's so I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I guess I don't feel my sort of weird take on it, and I don't know how much rambly detail you want me to go into, but it was, you know, with the previous referendum, I'm not Scottish. I've been to Scotland, I think, 3 or 4 times in my life. my view was, as surely we should, solidarity should cross national boundaries, and it's better for us to stick together so we can make things better for everyone rather than carve ourselves off with, you know, prehistoric nationalism or whatever. Whereas now, post Brexit, I'm sort of, part of me is thinking, well, yeah, I can see why they want to do that.
Yeah, mate.
I can't really begrudge them.
I mean, that's what I got. Whenever I hear Nicola Sturgeon do one of those like really strong speeches that she tends to do, well, like at least a couple of times a year now, in front of the Saltire and a European flag, I'm like, oh, why was I born down here? Because I feel like politics up there is dynamic and exciting and like actually represents people's views in some way, shape or form.
There's a lot of Scottish people who would dispute that, I think. I mean, apart from anything else, obviously the SNP have almost all the MPs in Westminster, and they have just under a minority of MPs in the Scottish Parliament, but they're very firmly in charge. So there's a lot of people who won't feel their views represented. I also kind of think, when I watch Sturgeon, I don't get that impression that she's massively in control of events. But I'm obviously aware that other people have exactly the opposite view. So I think it might just be like, it depends on where you're coming from as far as, you know, the Scottish independence question goes.
She knows what she wants, and I really appreciate that. But to be completely honest, when she announced this, we knew that this was going to happen because I think it was in the SNP manifesto, they said that they, if there were a change in the circumstances between Scotland and the rest of the UK,
the UK and the rest of the EU.
The UK and the between Scotland and the rest of the UK.
No, it was if there was a change that involves, for instance, the UK leaving the EU. Maybe you're about to go on and say that.
Yes.
Yes. Sorry.
How dare you?
Stealing your thunder.
It's fine. That there would be grounds for another referendum, and I actually think that's fair. The circumstances that Scotland has now found itself in, especially seeing as the majority of Scots voted to remain in the European Union, is now being dragged out by Wales and Middle England. I think that it's totally fair that they get to decide, well, look how different we are as like various nations under the same banner. Maybe that banner needs to get torn up a little bit. I basically want to be Scotland.
I think the referendum is legitimate. I'm not sure that it will go that way. And I think the difficulties with kind of going back into the EU, and also the entire proposition, as it were, of Scotland being outside of the UK when the rest of the UK is outside of the EU is very different. And there's obviously questions about currency and that sort of thing.
But then I think we should also remember that the last time that they had the referendum in 2014, the polls started at like 70%
of people backing staying within the United Kingdom, and they're now starting at 50-50. And the momentum, for want of a better word, that the SNP have already on their side.
I actually think they don't have momentum anymore. They definitely had momentum during the original independence referendum, but the other way of looking at what you've just described is that they've already saturated the market for independence votes. And actually, support for independence has been hovering somewhere between 40 and 60 for a while, depending on the polls that you look at. And the polls that were published today all express some form of that result. So I'm not entirely sure about the argument, but I'm interested actually in, we're all kind of assuming this referendum will happen, I guess. So James, when do you think the referendum will happen? Do you think it'll happen before we actually leave the EU or afterwards?
I'm not enough of a sort of legal expert to really pitch an actual date. I mean, my understanding was she's petitioned the government with some sort of order, which I guess the government responds to. I don't know if they can just slap that down or whether it will happen or won't happen. I think the speculation, certainly I've read, seems to be that even if the government don't allow it, the SNP could hold like an advisory referendum. And I guess if the SNP do go through with that and it's taken seriously, then that will, you know, create a huge political weight. I don't know if they then have to have like a third referendum to properly legitimate it. If they did vote for independence, or whether that was,
but then the whole point of like an advisory referendum is that it's like more of a protest, and it doesn't get taken seriously. This happened in Catalonia, which is still part of Spain, that has a very strong independence movement. Loads of ties are often made between the Catalan question and the Scottish question, and they held an advisory referendum.
But on the other hand, we just held an advisory referendum.
Sorry, say again.
Sorry. On the other hand, we've just held an advisory referendum here, and look how that turned out.
Yeah, and that's going swimmingly, isn't it? Do you think, James, that this is it's fair that the SNP are deciding to hold another referendum so soon? Do you think that the case that they're making for the fact that the conditions between like the UK and the rest of the world have changed so dramatically that they have to be asked again?
I think there is certainly a strong case for it. I don't know if it's a slam dunk, but I certainly think it's a persuasive argument, because, you know, Brexit will be dominating, you know, the rest of our professional lives, certainly. You know, and the implications of that, the reconfiguring of the economy and all of the sort of rebound from that. So if Scotland do want to get out of it, that is a, you know, that is a significant shake-up of the sort of existing constitutional settlement. So yeah, I think it's certainly a strong argument. I don't know if it's a definitive one, but who knows? Who knows?
I mean, obviously, the original case for Scotland leaving the UK kind of hinged on things like the oil situation, and also the fact that, as I said before, the relationship between Scotland and the rest of the UK wouldn't be too disrupted because they'd both still be within the EU. Do you think the kind of material circumstances have changed enough that would it swing your vote if you were making a decision on this? And also, do you think it will swing the Scottish people's votes?
I think it could do. I mean, the interesting thing to think about is if Scotland did become independent, did try to rejoin the EU, would it then be obliged to join the euro and join the Schengen zone, as all other new EU joiners are, you know, technically obliged to do, even if they haven't all joined both of those just yet? And then I wonder what that would do to almost, like, and I'm not sure this is exactly the phrase I'm looking for, but like the balance of power in the British Isles, because if Scotland is in the EU and we've got Ireland in the EU, could they both be tempted to join the Schengen zone and then completely screw us? So we'd have to have a hard border with Scotland.
Dig a ditch next to the wall.
Yeah, well, if Scotland are in the customs union, then presumably we'll have to have customs checks at Gretna Green. So, you know, you see politicians avoiding the Ireland question about what to do with the border there, because it's just too awkward for them to sort of think about. This would be a whole new level of just, you know, apocalyptic awkwardness.
Well, it would be quite nice for Gretna Green to have something more famous for it than just people going there and getting married at 16, wouldn't it? So good for them. I find it quite irritating that a lot of people are bringing up the economic question with Scotland again, because we've figured out now after the Brexit vote that people don't care about economics, right? Mm. They don't care that they're going to shoot themselves in the feet.
Some people don't care enough, or they have other considerations. But for some people, the economy will have swung their vote in the EU referendum. It will have swung their vote in the Scottish referendum too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's totally relevant. It isn't the defining factor.
But that, I feel like that's being used as the defining factor of the uncertainty of life outside of the union. It all just sounds so similar to the arguments that were made for Brexit. And if I were Scottish right now, I'd be going, well, fuck you. And just like throw caution to the wind. It can't get much worse. Because either, I said this on Twitter, and you can follow me at Jazza John if you so desire, that for Scotland, it feels like either you stay in the UK and Brexit ends up deciding your economic future and fucking with it, and that gets decided by a Conservative government, the way that you guys end up dealing with it, or you get to be masters of your own fuckery. Like, everybody gets fucked regardless, but at least it's a consensual fuck if they leave the UK.
Yeah, I mean, if you were running the Better Together campaign version 2, what argument would you use this time round in the Scottish referendum?
You're asking me.
I'm asking. Well, James is obviously welcome to pitch in as well.
I'd say, fuck it, get out. that's how much I believe in it. But James, go on. You might have a more sensible answer.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think it's a much harder argument to make now, because especially even, you know, and given the collapse of the Labour Party as well, the fact that now the pitch to Scotland is, if you stick with us, you've got Tory government for, you know, conceivably the rest of your life. It's a very hard pitch to make. Though, I guess, and I'm not entirely sure how you sort of sell this to an electorate, but the dangers for us, you know, if Scotland was independent, the politics of Scotland itself would be sort of in a really interesting situation, because you'd have the SNP as this overwhelmingly dominant party. They'd be, you know, like the ANC in South Africa or something, where they're sort of a tokenistic tiny little opposition party, but with political life just completely dominated by this one party, which creates sort of interesting democratic questions. And also, and I think this has already happened in Scotland, so I don't know how they can sort of reverse out of this. Maybe when they get independence, it'll sort of go back to normal. But Scotland's politics now is almost essentially sectarian, because it's, you know, are you pro-independence or are you pro-union? It's not, are you economically left or right? It's sort of framed around a different axis, which is, you know, seems slightly regressive in my view to sort of frame it like that. But that's how it is. Maybe if Scotland was independent, it would get back to, you know, should the state control more or less of the economy or something.
I think the one thing that the Remain, oh God, I'm calling them the Remain camp, the Better Together camp, have, one of the positives that they have, is Ruth Davidson, who's the leader of the opposition in the Scottish Parliament and the leader of the Conservatives in Scotland. She is brilliant, and she is incredibly popular as an individual within Scotland, and is probably the main reason why the Conservatives were able to bunny hop Labour in the last regional elections. I would just, if I were being serious and I was running the Better Together campaign, I'd basically have Ruth as the face of it and have her run the fucking thing, because she's so effective at being an opposition leader in the way that Labour never were in the run-up to the Scottish referendum in 2014.
Though the danger she's got is that she's theoretically tied directly to the Tories in Westminster, so presumably the SNP will just try and throw as much shit on her as possible from what's happening down south. I completely agree that she's, you know, she's the most likable Tory I've ever seen. But
kickboxing lesbian, she's brilliant.
But you know, she's got the political, you know, dead weight of Theresa May chained to her ankle or whatever.
But she's managed to transcend that in the past. And takes the Scottish Conservatives to their biggest win at Holyrood ever. And so I don't know how much that can stick to her. And I think that she is probably the best bet of having a a positive and a optimistic view of Scotland within the UK. She's the best person to sell that. But who's gonna do that for Labour? Kezia bloody Dugdale.
It's another situation, isn't it, where Labour gets squeezed between two things, because the Tories will have this mantle of we are the party of the union, the SNP will have we are the party of Scotland, and Labour are just sort of, you know, pissing around in the middle, losing votes. It's the same, as is happening post the EU referendum.
So, speaking of the EU referendum, Article 50 has is now allowed to be triggered whenever Theresa May wants.
You don't sound happy about that.
Oh, I know. I'm ecstatic.
Isn't it better we get it over with, or do you buy the argument that some people are making that it should be pushed back so the government can have more thinking time or whatever?
I don't really care anymore. It's going to happen, isn't it? I think in terms of logistics, it has to... I feel like it has to happen before the next European parliamentary election is held, because otherwise that gets really, really confusing. Because technically we still, like, Article 50 has been triggered, but technically we're still a member of the EU when it comes to May 2019. Mm. And so really it needs to be triggered, like, pretty damn soon in order for us to not be a member that doesn't have an election. And then, like, legally, that becomes, like, a whole nother shit show.
Mm. But, I mean, a legal shit show is going to happen one way or the other. Is that, like, a particularly bad obstacle?
But even more
obstacle?
Of a legal shit show. So I feel like British citizens would have a case to take to courts of their democratic rights being taken away from them when a state that is technically still a member of the European Union then decides not to hold the election of their officials, no matter how short the period of time is, that they would be sent to Brussels. It unnecessarily complicates things, and I don't think that's another thing that Theresa May would want to have on her plate, to be completely honest.
Sure. I mean, James, are you assuming that May is actually going to trigger Article 50 by the end of March, like she said? Is it certain now?
I think it's going to have to be. I'll be very surprised if it doesn't, because it'll have to be a sort of another crippling U-turn, like, you know, a million times worse than the one today with about the national insurance, because she said, you know, the end of May, that's what it will be, that's what everyone's counting down to not do that, that would be humiliating. And the other problem is, whilst, you know, people like me are hoping, you know, it could get delayed or, you know, not happen for whatever reason, she's beholden to the Brexiteers, you know, to her right, who are, you know, are baying for blood if it won't happen. So she's stuck. She's in a bind. I think she's going to have to trigger it, annoyingly.
Yeah. And I don't even feel like she is in a bind. I think she wants to. It doesn't feel like she is cautious or tentative about this particular thing. I mean, like, she decided not to do it as soon as becoming Prime Minister, but then set out a very sensible and very well thought out, we all think, time frame in order to do it, and she doesn't seem like the kind of person that's going to change her mind on that. Next couple of weeks, look forward to it.
I suppose politically her problem is she's thinking, well, if I need to be all in on Brexit or my party splits in half, because, you know, that would inevitably happen. She's seeing off, you know, the UKIP threat, but also, you know, the half the Tory party or more, I don't know the exact numbers, who are pro-Brexit. And I guess all of the Tory Remainers, they're going to be more of the, oh, well, it's a democratic decision, so we have to do it and make it horrible and get out the customs union. They're going to be more accepting of that argument than lefties like I am.
But the Conservatives are all Brexiters now.
That's their line. Anna Soubry and Ken Clark.
And Ken Clark.
And Michael Heseltine as well.
They're my favourites.
But yeah, that's the thing. If she doesn't trigger it, then she's got a hugely split party, because again, because at the moment they're united because they all seem to have a vague plan. If she don't trigger it, it's all disarray, and she's got a huge political problem.
I mean, we kind of discussed this last week, but William Hague obviously suggested that Theresa May should call a general election. I realised, I think we made a slight mistake in the last podcast, and we didn't talk about the idea that Theresa May can hold a vote of no confidence and effectively boot herself out of office to trigger another general election. Do you think that that's a good idea? Do you think that's something that she should have done before going through this whole Brexit process or preparing for it?
It does seem like it would be wise. Think about it. Again, I'm not entirely sure at the timing, but and I drawing from historical parallels is always, you know, fraught with difficulty. But obviously, you can think, look what happened to Gordon Brown, you know, as the sort of most recent historical example of not causing a general election and then completely losing your political footing. I guess the reason she's not is because she thinks, well, I've got a completely hopeless opposition leader. I can do what I want anyway. Where's the sort of political imperative? Because if we had the general election the day after, Labour would once again have a barely, you know, a broadly competent leader putting up more of a fight. Mm. So I guess that's the sort of thing that's pushing her against it. But maybe we do need an election. But again, if the forces of Remain won that election, that would then cause even more confusion. So it's a tricky one. I don't know. Sorry.
That's okay. you mentioned this earlier, James. The U-turn that people bloody love that phrase, don't they? It's blooming everywhere.
It's easy
today
to fit in a headline.
It is. It's like five letters. That the Conservative government had to make after the announcement of the budget last week on the proposed increase of national insurance for self-employed people. This got people all a fuss, didn't it, really? Because this is meant to be the party for working people. It's meant to encourage people to go out on their own and make their own way in the world. And they also broke a manifesto promise of raising national insurance on anyone.
But as I understand it, which admittedly is not very well, but
that's okay.
They made some change to the pension rules last year, which basically gave self-employed people greater pension benefits. Mm-hmm. And this change was apparently, or justified, to kind of bring the national insurance contributions in line with employed people, regularly employed people, I don't know what the word would be, who are obviously paying, who are obviously already paying those higher national insurance contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And it also doesn't really affect the proverbial white van man all that much, because it's a graded tax or contribution, if you like.
But there was that fairness, but there's also the fact that self-employed people technically they don't get sick pay, they don't get a holiday, they won't get a whole ream of benefits that people who are employed by a larger company actually get. And I think that there was quite rightly an uproar about it, not only because I was directly affected by this.
Did either of you work out how badly you'd be affected by the changes?
No, I don't do maths.
No. James, did you?
I was waiting for someone to invent an online calculator that would do it. I haven't found one yet. So I don't know exactly how I'll be affected. But I think the bigger thing, you know, I know you said that the relatively few, quotes, white van men won't be affected. But I think there is a sort of a bigger pool of people who will be hit. So, you know, like Uber drivers and Amazon delivery drivers, these are all technically freelance contractors.
Mm-hmm.
Who, as I understand it, I think the cutoff was about 16 grand, and if you went over that, you're hit by it. And like the average Uber driver, so I read, makes about 23 grand. Mm-hmm. So you know that there will certainly be a hit there. So I think that's a sort of concerning thing. But the thing I find interesting about it is you can sort of make the progressive case both ways on this one, as far as I can tell, because you've got that, which is why do you want to hit people who are struggling in the gig economy? But then you can also equally make the argument, people who have employers, their employers also chip in on their national insurance. It just doesn't see their salaries. So shouldn't self-employed people who are also their own employers also be paying in, because ultimately they'll be claiming the same cash out, I guess.
Mm.
See what I mean?
I mean, they ultimately decided to U-turn on this, and it seemed to be framed today at Prime Minister's Questions. We're recording this on Wednesday. That it was very much framed as we basically forgot that we promised this in the manifesto of the last Prime Minister.
Mm.
This should have been, and we know this because it's a U-turn, this should have been a wide-open goal for our fave, Mr. Corbyn.
This is very cynical of you, Jazza, as part of the mainstream media, to use this as an opportunity to attack and delegitimize Jeremy Corbyn.
Are we part of the mainstream media now, Jimmy?
I don't think so.
When did this happen?
I'm just bringing in the critics before you actually say what you have to say.
All right, okay, cool. But he was. Did you see Prime Minister's Questions today, James? Or have you read anything about it?
I followed the coverage on Twitter. I missed the actual thing because I was doing some other work. But you know, I then scrolled up through my timeline.
That's
across,
okay. We didn't give it as homework. 30. It's fine. We
yeah. And you know, I just saw like 400 people on my Twitter timeline just despairing at it all. So I thought, well, I don't really need to catch up on that. I don't hate myself that much.
So yeah. I think John Bercow, the Commons speaker, actually rebuked Jeremy Corbyn for not asking a question properly. Jeremy Corbyn just stood up and gave a statement rather than, you know, inquiring about some aspect of government policy.
Do you think that... So a lot of people are saying that this should have been a wide open goal, and he kept on just asking Theresa May to apologise. If you were the opposition leader, how would you have scored this goal, James?
I guess the open goal is simply asking, why have you done the U-turn? Isn't it? Isn't that a bit daft? Was it you who said to do the U-turn, or did Philip Hammond decide to do the U-turn? Because you know that's how you'd score points. Again, whether it's the right thing to do, maybe this was Corbyn's thinking, because you could make the argument that structurally, arguably, this is a change. I mean, if technocrats are in charge, maybe this is something that you know should happen, because more and more people are self-employed. We need to pay for national insurance somehow, or bring the pot up somehow. Maybe structurally it does make a degree of sense, which is why he wasn't. But as a political move. It seems crazy not to sort of go for it. He's just hopeless, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just not very good at politics, though. I reckon he actually believed that the national insurance on self-employed people should have been raised, because he doesn't really like people who are
self-employed, make money.
Who make money, who go out on their own. Do you think that that's an accurate... like guess, Jimmy?
I'm willing to believe he's just incompetent. I don't think any further reason needs to be given.
So I'm starting to wonder if he's actually, you know, an agent. He's like the left wing equivalent.
He's a Soviet agent.
Or not a Soviet. You know, like how Spiked magazine. They're, you know, they do all this sort of right wing stuff, but they're actually run by a Marxist group. And,
yeah, so they were made out of the ashes of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
Yeah.
Which then weirdly all moved politically over to the libertarian kind of side of the coin in tandem with one another.
But I think like the conspiracy theory there is that the idea is that they'll bring down capitalism from the inside by taking it to its successors or something. Maybe Corbyn's doing the same thing. Maybe he's trying to discredit the left in its entirety by just being completely inept. I don't know.
It's definitely a long game plan.
Yeah, I don't think he really knows how to try. Jimmy, how would you have scored this open goal? You good at footy?
Not really, but no. the most obvious thing was that the Tories came out with these attack ads during the 2015 general election, where they slated Ed Miliband for proposing basically exactly what they proposed regarding national insurance. So I'd have just gone with that, and it was a significant part of their campaign. There's loads of Tories on the high ranking Tories on the record condemning the national insurance plan that was Labour's in 2015, including Theresa May. It was about as easy a thing to attack in Prime Minister's Questions as you get, basically.
Mm-hmm. If you're a fan of like ironic retweets of Tory MPs from 2015 saying raising NI is a bad idea, then the Scottish referendum version 2 is going to be brilliant for that. It's just going to be full of people going, oh no, what about the economy? And then we'll retweet this about, what's that about taking back control? Surely the lesson in this is you don't promise to not raise taxes, whatever, because no one can predict the future.
Just leaving the EU and us needing to have some kind of a cushion financially when we actually get out.
Exactly, it's stupid. It's like saying, you know, I'm never going to buy a car when you might get a new job where you need one. That's a really poor example. I don't know why I came up with that, but you see what I mean. Why tie yourself down with something so obviously stupid, which could come back to bite you? I don't know.
Yeah, but James, you are basically saying that parties shouldn't have manifestos now, really, aren't you?
No, they just should be vague and fluffy.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a fair critique of my viewers. But the thing is, this here's a controversial opinion. Do people really care about the details of manifestos? Do people who aren't political journalists ever actually read them? Isn't a vote for a party arguably more of a statement of broad values, and is more of a sort of, this is my in-group, this, you know, I'm voting for the Labour Party because I am, you know, working class and they will look out for my interests. I'm voting for the Tories because I live in the southeast and, you know, own my own business. Maybe that's how democracy falls apart. I don't know.
I mean, I thought that was the standard opinion of manifestos, but, you know, maybe I'm just cynical like that.
Yeah, I read them every time we have an election and then make videos about them so more people know.
Jazza reads them, but no one else does.
Yeah, nobody else, let's be fair. So shall we talk about our final topic, the ECJ ruling on headscarves in, well, no, sorry, generic religious symbols in the workplace. Jimmy, can you break it down for us a little bit once you've stopped fiddling with your phone?
I'm just trying to bring up said story. So the gist of the story, as Jazza just sarcastically outlined, is that this isn't really a ban on headscarves, although it has been portrayed as such. It's saying that employers, if they have a legitimate reason, such as wanting to appear publicly neutral, can ban any kind of religiously expressive clothing. So it would include things like crucifixes, or Jewish skull caps, or anything. But the policy has to be across the board. You can't just single out a particular religion. You have to say to all your employees of whatever faith they are, you cannot wear religious clothing. And it also cannot be something that's used to assuage customers, like you can't do it on the back of a customer complaint or something like that. So there's actually quite a lot of restrictions around the ruling, but obviously the headline thing is the headscarf.
So you see this talked about an awful lot in France, where they recently had the ban of the awkwardly named burkini, the full bodysuit that some Muslim women choose to wear when they go to the beach for modesty reasons. And I feel like the UK has always kind of been very staunch on, we will not tell people how to dress. That is your own right to decide how to do that. And I've always actually been quite proud of that stance that we've had. And this was something that Theresa May echoed today when she commented on the ruling itself as well. It's for all religious, like people of religious faith and religious and all types of religious clothing and symbols of religion. But at the end of the day, this affects women who wear the veil and Orthodox Jews, and not very many other people, right?
Well, it would depend on the company, but if a company decided to instill a ban, it would affect people that wear crucifixes in a visible way.
But practically, who does that? You can button up a shirt if you want to wear your crucifix, or you can wear a hat if you want to get away with not wearing a Jewish skull cap.
And in absolute terms, across the entirety of the EU, there must be more people who wear crucifixes openly than Muslims who wear headscarves, just because of pure absolute numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at it in a broad sense, it probably affects Christians more than it affects Muslims.
But it isn't going to affect Christians, right? Because that religious symbol is so subtle and can be worn underneath clothing. The nature of the veil is that it obscures either your hair, or if you're going for the full veil, the majority of your face. And that's the point of it. And it's only really those people who wear those religious clothing that are going to be affected by that. And so it is a broad religious thing, but it's going to adversely affect women from Muslim backgrounds, right?
I feel we should let James pitch in at this point.
James, go ahead. I get angry about these things. I'm so sorry.
I mean, my view, I can sort of, you know, in a sort of weird sense, you can understand the motivation for this. You know, I'm quite a staunch secularist. I think we should try and separate religions from public life and enable people to practice their faith freely, but, you know, without infringing on the rights of others. But it is sort of broadly unenforceable, I would have thought. I mean, you know, if I identify as a Jedi, do I get to carry my lightsaber around? Does that suddenly become a religious object?
It's an actual religion.
Exactly. Well, it's like, you know, if someone's just wearing a headscarf for non-religious reasons, do the police have to have a Muslim detector to try and figure out what the motivations is behind it? It seems frankly bizarre, and I do think it sort of, you know, crosses the line into illiberalism. And I guess ultimately, if you, you know, I suppose if you were to probe the intentions behind it, the most sort of charitable interpretation, rather than sort of Muslims are scary, would be, you know, you could take the feminist argument, which is it's a sign of patriarchy and oppression. Or something like that, when it's not necessarily in all cases, because you can't tell the intentions of why someone is wearing something just by looking at them. And even if it is, it doesn't mean it is for everyone. It just seems sort of bizarre and unenforceable. Sure, and drawing a blanket rule especially seems particularly tricky, given it's a question of line drawing. In different circumstances, different things could be appropriate. I mean, one example I can think of, and I think this sort of got some sort of Daily Express hysteria a few years ago, and I could be misremembering this slightly, but I think there was like a case of a nurse who wore a crucifix who got into trouble for, you know, for wearing this religious symbol because, you know, it indicated to patients that she was religious or something.
I vaguely remember this story.
But wasn't that about the fact that she wasn't allowed to wear any jewellery because she was a nurse, and it gets caught and lost in...
Yeah, possibly.
It usually turns out to be something like that, but there's Christian lobby groups who will take these as sort of... They try to create a sort of culture war like they have in America. So it's like, look, we're under attack. We're the oppressed faith now. Give us attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely true. I think that there's an interesting parallel with the lady who recently took her contractor employer to court for making her wear high-heeled shoes.
Yeah, I'm glad you actually brought this up.
Yeah, so like this was on the DAS podcast, which I'm now going to refer to as our sister podcast because I'm very fond of them. I feel like the difference there, and so she took them to court and she won, and because that was not expected of her male counterpart. Men in the same position would not be expected to wear high heels, for example. Do you think that there is any parallel between those two rulings at all, without obviously being experts in the legal world?
Well, one of the obvious things is that high heels are kind of bad for your feet. So, like, in a crude way, there is actually a health and safety argument there. If your employer is expecting you to do something that actually damages your body, mm-hmm. then, you know, there's legitimate pushback on that. But I guess primarily it is an aesthetic thing, right? Mm-hmm. But the other side of that is that I think that probably a lot of employers have uniform requirements that are different for men and women. So mm-hmm. where exactly do you draw the line of when that is and isn't appropriate? I mean, even Parliament actually has a dress code for men in the House of Commons, but no dress code for women.
Mm-hmm. Something that actually Oxford University does really well is that there's strict formal dress for men and women, and that's like laid out. But you can pick and choose from either of the categories and wear whatever you want. So as long as you're wearing something from, as long as you're wearing an appropriate amount of clothing and either or a mix of the two, then you can wear whatever you want.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable way of doing it.
It does seem like a feasible way of doing it. James, I wanted to ask you, do you think that, so Theresa May said that this was not something that government would ever should ever rule and should never tell people what to wear, apart from in particular cases when, for example, somebody is wearing a veil in the courtroom, or when there are like police interviews or those kinds of scenarios. Do you think that there's ever a case for that not to be the case, where people would be able to wear whatever they wanted in those spaces?
I think, and again, I haven't given this issue too much thought, so I don't want this to be.
That's okay. We won't hold it.
This is your final opinion for all time. So make it a good one.
It seems broadly sensible. For example, you know, if you're going through passport control, it's probably a good idea for the passport person to be able to check it's the person on the passport. So you know, to not have to wear like a full headscarf which obscures the face, that seems like a sensible thing to do. But again, I think these are sort of fringe things, so it's like it's almost missing the point, because what is this, what are rules designed to try and achieve, what by banning things or not banning things is the intent. These fringe cases are by definition fringe cases. So do they matter? Is that a stupid thing to say? I'm not really sure what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it does matter, because if somebody is sent home for wearing a religious symbol that still adheres to, like, is still able to look formal or to look appropriate for the space that it's in, then I think that this ruling is the wrong decision, because it implies that wearing a veil can make people look unprofessional or make people look. Make a company look bad, and I understand the argument.
The court reasoned that they looked at it more from an employer employee kind of thing, and if the employer wants to exude a certain image of just neutrality and uniformity, the court seemed to feel that that was a legitimate business interest, and you could argue when and when that wouldn't be. And it even in the bits of the ruling that were quoted in the article I was reading, it did give some leeway about and said it had to be kind of appropriate and reasonable. Obviously, from an employer's point of view, that's a nightmare, because what is appropriate and reasonable, that's very difficult to determine.
I also have a bit of an issue, and you're going to accuse me of being a social justice warrior now, but I have an issue with the idea of women who wear the veil for religious reasons not being able to be perceived as like neutral or as plain and just being able to do their job. It's as if the veil has to be some kind of overt political statement. And it gets a lot of people riled up because it defines people very clearly when we first see them. But I don't understand why it can't just be an asterisk and a side note rather than the thing that apparently defines a person. And I feel like it's other people's bigotry that has brought this in front of the court, and other people's bigotry that has made them win. So there, retweet that.
I agree with what you're saying, but it makes me wonder. It surely, in a sense, it's almost impossible to dress neutrally, as by choosing what you're wearing, you're making some sort of statements. But it is basically. I agree with what you're saying about other people are projecting their, you know, their values, opinions, and bigotries.
Discomfort, shall we call them, rather than bigotries, because that got Gordon Brown in trouble in 2010.
Oh, psyche.
I mean, some of it is bigotries, you know. I mean, it seems this kind of connects to both your points, but there are very obvious common sense things that could be done in certain situations which wouldn't really trouble anyone particularly. And also, I think most employers probably don't really care about issues like this. You know, they're probably indifferent one way or the other. But
there'll be a bed and breakfast in like Cornwall that...
There will be fringe cases, but by and large, this doesn't matter. It's just that in the national dialogue that, you know, it gets pulled into this whole culture wars thing that we're having over issues like secularism and anti-Islamism and all of that sort of thing. And people get horrendously riled up, which is sad.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Shall we wrap up there? Are we okay with the conversations we've had?
I think so.
Oh, very good. James, if your employer wants to inform you that you're now fired for representing their views, how can they get in touch with you on Twitter?
I'm on Twitter. I'm Scythor. That's Psythor.
Is that a Pokemon reference?
No, not intentionally. It was just sort of a weird thing. I made it up years ago when I was literally like 14 or something, and it was because it was quite unique. So it means wherever I registered, it could just be the same. But yeah,
most people do give up those internet usernames they come up with when they're 14.
I know. Well, some bastard's already got like James O'Malley on Twitter, or you know, otherwise I'd have that. But no, I need to try and get that back, get that off him somehow.
Scythor, Jimmy, where can they find you?
At JDE Nichols.
And if you hate everything about me, please find me on Twitter at JazzaJohn. You can also find us on the website rightdishonorable.com and also Right Dishonor on Twitter.
Yes, you got there in the end.
Yes, eventually.
Should we wrap up then?
Yeah. Cool. Bye-bye. Bye.
Cool. Thanks.
Oh, look, it's an extra bit. I mean, listen, it's an extra bit.
Yes.
We've decided, I'll be frank with you, listener. We decided we wanted to do more user engagement.
Hashtag user engagement.
Or your viewer or audience engagement. We're now going to call you the Dishonorables. You're like
our... the deplorables.
Yeah. Oh, that is good though.
Yeah.
Maybe instead of dear listener, I'm going to start calling them the dishonorables.
He's looking super excited Win. Right now.
But basically, this is a chance for us to prove to you that we do actually read the stuff that you write about us. Mm. Some of you may be more happy about that than others. For example, the most recent review that we have on iTunes is still the one from October in 2006. Why has nobody else reviewed us? How dare you? I asked you to do that so much. where we were described as an interesting young white male Southeast England take on politics, not always well informed, particularly on issues outside their experience. Well, if any review is accurate,
As I said the last time we read out his review, he has listened to the show.
Yeah. Very well, and gave us 3 stars, which I feel like is not bad based on that review.
Yeah, we probably wouldn't have to do too much to get a 5-star review for that guy.
No, exactly. We also got a tweet from Marky on the Twitter, who just voted for us for the British Podcast Awards. So that's given our the number of votes we have up to 3. You mean Marky.
Marky, yeah. So please go on. Is it BritishPodcastAwards.com/vote?
Yes.
And
vote for us.
Please vote for us, because we were slightly too slow to enter ourselves in the proper competition.
Yeah, so now we have to enter into the voter's choice.
We have to beg people for votes.
Yeah, which actually means that there's no chance in hell that we will ever be anyone who is going for the voter's choice awards.
I mean, it's a good experience, though, for a political podcast, begging people for votes. It's on topic, on brand.
It is very,
as you would say.
Very on brand. Why does nobody else do it?
So, Nikki Daly, or Daly, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce that, basically chastised us on Twitter for not releasing the Mikola podcast as quickly as we might have done.
I did really enjoy that. That was quite fun.
It's difficult to explain what it is, because it's quite contextual. But I did, you know, I received your chastisement and I did put the podcast up. So, you know. Mm-hmm. I did respond.
What was really hilarious was that this came like 2 or 3 days after me bugging Jimmy to just put up the podcast anyway.
No, that never happens.
Yeah, it did.
It literally never happens.
Literally happened. Anyway, as always, you guys know how to get in touch with us.
Well, there's more.
Oh, there's more?
There's more.
I mean, don't use it all up, because we've only got a week until the next episode. We've got to be really tactful about this.
Okay, there are more, but we won't be telling them to you. Right now.
This was a mess. This is the worst, but also the best idea I think we've ever had.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's very like the start of the Right Dishonourable, just chaos. We've actually got far better the rest of the time.
You know what's great? That at the very beginning of the Right Dishonourable, we thought that we were really, really good. But I went back and watched those dreaded videos, and it was appalling.
Appalling?
Yeah, it was appalling. We weren't great.
So
we were more informed, though. We did our research back then.
Ah. Mm. So you're saying we're better now or worse now?
I don't know. It's a bit yin and yang, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, right, bye.
Bye.
Why aren't you reviewing us on iTunes? Okay, bye.